main results that we derived last time?
We looked at something about reproducing density when we're estimating estimate.
Okay, that was sort of an intermediate tool.
What was the main result from last class?
Oh, that you can overtrain a Bayesian measurement.
That was the main observation.
That's true. But what about, we derived a couple really important equations, and I want to build on that today. How about some of the other guys? Can't remember from last class. All right, so that's a problem. Because, when we sit here in class with the PowerPoint slides, everything seems nice and neat and clean. And then 2 minutes outside the door, it all evaporates. Though I know some of you are taking notes, and I appreciate that. I think that's really good. But we've got to start keeping some of the basic concepts in our working memory in this class. And so I hope that people are keeping up with reading the textbook and such. If you wait until the few days before the midterm to try to cram for this, that's probably not going to work. So last time we talked about how we can estimate the mean and variance from a data set using both data gathered from the actual measurements and using knowledge of the prior information. And we essentially ended up with a set of equations that you can think of as a mixture of knowledge about the specific data set and knowledge about the prior means and such. And I'll review those equations in a moment, but in the absence of prior information, if you wanted to compute the mean, you just take the mean of the data. But with knowledge about the prior, we can use that to refine our estimate of the mean when we have finite data sets. Now in the limit, if we have infinite amounts of data, the influence of the priors become minimal because you can essentially estimate the priors from the large set of data. But we all, in the real world, deal with finite data sets, and therefore anything we can do to improve our estimate by using knowledge in addition to the actual data itself is important. So, to try to drive this home a little anecdote this morning. So I'm driving in this morning, and I'm listening to the radio, and the commercial comes on for a tax firm, Jackson Hewitt, which actually has an office in town here. And Magic Johnson does the commercial. Now, how many of you understand what income tax is?
Most of America, maybe. You guys don't know anything about income tax?
Yeah, some income tax.
Government.
Yes.
I think this is universal in all countries. Governments take your money, right? So, remember last class I talked about the euro coin and I pointed you to a paper on that, and I hope you had a chance to look at that paper. Well, a similar story struck me this morning on the radio. So, Magic Johnson is a famous basketball player, retired now. And he says in this commercial that because 9 out of 10 people who go to Jackson Hewitt receive a refund, Jackson Hewitt is a really good tax firm. Okay. Convincing. I mean, it sounds reasonable. He says, in sports, if you won 9 out of 10 games, you'd be a great team. Yes. So, what is wrong with that argument? And actually, I've heard this commercial a lot, but it just sort of struck me as I was thinking about pattern recognition on the way in. What's wrong with this commercial?
What's the probability that 9 out of 10 people get their refund from all the other firms, too? Or out of the whole country, for that matter?
So how would you express that in terms of, excellent, so how would you express that in terms of concepts we've discussed in this course?
Would that be your P of omega I?
Your prior, right? Probably 9 out of 10 people get a tax return, get a return on their taxes, because typically you pay in more taxes than you receive. Now, I'm not sure of that, but I'm guessing that I'm thinking there's two things wrong with this commercial. One is this information about the prior. probably a high percentage of people already get a refund without any kind of doing anything special. You can go to TurboTax and just punch up your short form and all this kind of thing. That's one thing that's wrong. And then the second thing wrong, which I think also you brought out in your statement, is what is this, in addition to the priors, there's two components to the overall probabilities, the priors and the likelihood. So now let's talk about the likelihood, which is something you also mentioned.
That would be the P of X given omega.
Yeah. So this commercial is trying to convince you to use Jackson Hewitt over H&R Block or whoever else, the TurboTax or whoever else does these things. What's the key piece of missing information in this commercial with respect to that? And you said it when you answered.
The probability that if I go to another one, I'll get the same.
You'll get the same thing, right? So you can go to TurboTax, which is completely automated, and probably get the same return. In fact, offline I'll tell you my little story about using accountants versus TurboTax. But TurboTax has gotten pretty good. So what is the piece of information they should be giving you on this commercial? Instead of saying 9 out of 10 people get a return when they use us.
So 9 out of 10 people didn't get a refund somewhere else.
Exactly. If they could say something like that, like 6 out of 10 or 7 out of 10 people who did not get a return at H&R Block or some of the other terms got a return with us, now they're telling you two things. They're beating the basic priors and they're doing better than the other firms. But of course they can't say that because more than likely with any of these firms you get about the same return, and the return is about what you would get with TurboTax. So not to get down on Jackson Hewitt, but it's an interesting example, I think, of exactly what McKay talks about in the Europoint example. Depending on how your view of the priors, your conclusion about a observation of an experimental outcome can change significantly. So 9 out of 10 sounds impressive, but then when you start breaking that down into priors, into likelihoods, into performance measured against the other firms, that, you know, then you're not so sure anymore. And one thing I've learned over the years with statistics is a good statistician can convince you of anything. I don't care what the outcome is. It's amazing how they can manipulate things to make it almost any outcome seem reasonable. So, with that in mind, we began our introduction to Bayesian parameter estimation. We talked about how we're going to estimate class conditional densities by trying to estimate priors and likelihoods. We're going to typically ignore the evidence in classification, but in modeling the class conditional density, we have to take into account the evidence. We considered a simple case, univariate Gaussian, where the mean was unknown, and we derived these two equations. These were the equations I was trying to see if you remembered, and those of you who took took adaptive signal processing also saw these equations. It's a form of adaptation in that it's saying essentially our starting point is the prior, some prior knowledge we have about the mean. An example of this might be if you were asked to estimate the number of males and females in the U.S., your mu zero could be 50%, because in the absence of no other knowledge, you might say, well, it's a 50-50 chance, equal numbers of males and females. But then as you observe samples, as you sit outside the door here in Simrall and start counting people, that becomes your measurements, and you can then estimate mu n hat. And then what's remarkable about this equation is it says, here's a principled way to mix knowledge about the actual data you've collected and knowledge about the priors. And I'm seeing some blank faces, but I'll continue. We talked about how Bayesian learning tends to very sharply, very aggressively try to converge, try to reduce variance, try to approach the true value of the distribution. So it's very common with Bayesian learning to see these distributions become very, very sharp with a very small number of data points. And there are a couple of plot examples of this taken from the textbook. Now, what we want to do today, a couple things. We want to go back and revisit this concept of a class conditional density and build it out of the components that we now know how to estimate. And we want to talk about multivariate, we want to generalize from a univariate Gaussian case to a multivariate Gaussian case. So how do we obtain the P of X given D, given what we've discussed now with our Bayesian approach? Well, P of X given D can be written as P of X given mu times P of mu given D. And we have to integrate that over all mu. So this is essentially just a way of taking into account the mean of our model. So we have P of X given D, we're going to estimate by, remember we're still talking about the univariate Gaussian case, P of X given D we're going to estimate as some model, like a Gaussian distribution, that has a mean and a variance. Now for this analysis we're assuming we know the variance and we're only focusing on the mean. So the model for X is conditioned only on the mean, so we have P of X given mu, and then we multiply that by the prior P of mu given D. Now we have an expression for our model, that's essentially a Gaussian distribution, and we have an expression for the prior, which is essentially also a Gaussian distribution with a mean, a true mean here at mu sub n. So we now have these two Gaussians, and this is very common with Bayesian analysis to see this product of Gaussians. Now the derivation of this is a little bit difficult because you're integrating the product of two Gaussians, but the result we can sort of look at and verify intuitively. The result of this integral turns out to be a Gaussian-like expression where you have a mean mu sub n and variance, a combined variance of sigma squared plus sigma n squared, times this function, which is a function of sigma and sigma n. And this function of sigma and sigma n is this integral of this term raised to the exponentiated, and we have in that term sigma squared plus sigma n squared divided by sigma squared sigma n squared, and then we have a quadratic term. There should be a closed bracket here. We have a quadratic term, the mu, the mean minus a term which is a combination of the data and mu sub n and the two variances. So the main observation here is that this probability of X given D is proportional to a Gaussian distribution which has a mean of mu sub n and a variance of sigma squared plus sigma n squared. And what do we know about sigma n squared as n becomes large? What?
Sharp.
Well, we would like, in the limit, what do we expect this, if this is proportional to a Gaussian, in the limit, what do we expect this Gaussian to converge to? So as n goes to infinity, this P of X given D, D now is, in, we have enough data.
It should become just like an impulse like spike.
Right, but the overall, this is a generative model, right? This is a probability of how we generate the data. With infinite amounts of data, what do you expect this to converge to? Well, it should converge to our estimate of the mean and the variance, the true mean and variance. So what we see here, we see sort of the impact that n, the number of samples, has on the overall model, and we see the variance, the sort of the impact on the mean. So if we go back, So So this is our expression from U sub n. And we talked about how this is a combination of the prior mean and our estimate of the mean. And then what does this converge to when n goes to infinity? This just converges to our estimate of the mean. This is sigma n squared. Again, what happens to this as n goes to infinity? Well, this term dominates this term, and we're left with just sigma squared. We're left with sigma squared over n there. And so the so this probability of x given d then is proportional to a Gaussian whose mean is mu sub n and whose variance is sigma squared plus sigma n squared. But we know that this mu sub n is going to converge to the estimated mean of the data, and this sigma squared plus sigma n squared is going to converge to sigma squared. So the conditional mean is treated essentially as the true mean as n becomes large. And this p of x given d and p of omega sub j being the priors, this is used to design the classifier. Now, why are Bayesian techniques sort of so difficult? Well, you can see that even in the simplest cases, it's going to be very difficult to do any kind of analytical work on this p of x given d, because even in the simplest case we get a very complicated expression. That's why with many, many Bayesian techniques, they're very heavily numerical in nature. You use gradient search type algorithms to try to find the optimal parameters and things, because you cannot really solve these equations in the solve them analytically for decision surfaces and such for most cases. Now, the main thing we want to talk about today is we want to generalize this to the multivariate case, building on what we've seen in the univariate case. So, in the multivariate case, we have a vector x instead of a scalar, and we have a mean vector mu instead of a scalar. So, we have bold, I use bold for the vectors and matrices. And we're going to assume that they're proportional, that this density is proportional to a Gaussian whose mean is mu and whose covariance is sigma. And then we're also going to assume for the priors that this is also the priors on mu, the mean, not x, but the prior on mu is also Gaussian with a mean of mu zero and a covariance matrix of sigma sub zero. And we're going to assume that sigma, sigma zero, and mu zero are assumed to be known, which is a big assumption, but we're just trying to illustrate the approach, the Bayesian approach here. And it's barely tractable for this simple case. So applying Bayes' formula, we have that the probability of mu given d is just going to be the product of the probabilities of the individual vectors in that set D, because we're assuming statistical independence. When you draw one vector, it does not influence the outcomes of all the other vectors. So this probability is going to be proportional to, there'll be some constant here, but it's mainly proportional to a product of the individual elements generated from a distribution, in this case Gaussian, times p of mu. So we have p of x sub k given mu times p of mu. So this p of x sub k given mu, this is essentially expressing the probability that you drew a particular vector x from a distribution whose mean was mu, and then p of mu is the prior on that mean. And again, what makes this Bayesian is the incorporation of this prior, which you have not seen previously when you've done work with likelihood techniques. Now this, for a Gaussian distribution, we have essentially a product of exponential terms, much like we had in the scalar case. And then for the prior, we have also a product of an exponential term. So when you multiply all these exponential terms together, what you end up essentially with is a sum of the arguments. So skipping quite a few steps here, we can show that the product of these two can be factored into a form which looks somewhat familiar to us. We have some constant times e, and then the argument of e is minus 1/2, the first term of that. Then we have this, for the first term, we have mu transpose times an expression in parentheses, which I'll explain in a second, times mu. So we have a quadratic form featuring the mean, and this term in the middle, this is essentially a modified inverse covariance matrix, which is a function of our initial estimate or our prior on the covariance matrix sigma sub zero and the covariance of the data that we've measured, that the model here, and this is essentially a mixture of the two. So as n becomes large, this term is going to dominate, which comes from the likelihood. When n is small, perhaps this term is going to dominate, which comes from the prior. So we essentially, again, have a mixing of the prior information and the covariance of the likelihood model. And then we have a, if you remember in the derivation for the scalar case, we had things proportional to mu squared, and then we had things proportional to mu. So for the things proportional to mu, we have sigma inverse times the sums of the x sub k's plus sigma sub zero inverse times mu zero. So again, we have a mixing of the data that we measure, the covariance of the model that generated that data, and the prior information, the mean weighted by the inverse covariance matrix. Now, much like we did before, you can take this distribution and essentially equate it to a Gaussian distribution of this form, and then you can sort of solve, equate similar parts and solve for an expression for the means for mu sub n's and mu. So this thing has a form of a quadratic mu minus mu sub n transpose times sigma inverse times mu minus mu sub n. This is exactly what we did in the scalar case, only we were dealing with scalar elements. And for last lecture, you have you know, the details of that derivation. That's one of the reasons why we go through the details. The details for this are fairly similar, but now you're dealing with vectors and matrices versus scalars. So, you know, here, these are essentially the things in this quadratic associated with mu squared and associated with mu. And what we can do then is to equate these two terms and solve for mu's, and we'll do that in a second. But once again, we have this observation that when we make these Gaussian assumptions, the product of the Gaussians also becomes Gaussian. So this is what we call a reproducing density, because the probability of mu given d is essentially also a Gaussian. These were Gaussians, these were Gaussians, the product of all these things are Gaussian, so p of mu given d is Gaussian. So that's what we call a reproducing density when you start with Gaussians and you end up with Gaussians. So we can equate coefficients between these two Gaussians and show that we have these three equations. Let me go back for a second. So what we're going to do, again, following what we did last time for the Scalar case. So we've got a Gaussian here, and we want a Gaussian of this form. So we can essentially equate coefficients between this distribution and this distribution. And if we do that, we end up with these three equations. Sigma sub n inverse is equal to n times sigma inverse plus sigma sub zero inverse. Sigma sub n inverse times mu sub n is equal to n sigma inverse times mu n hat, where mu n hat is our estimate of the mean, and sigma sub zero inverse times mu sub zero. So two equations plus this auxiliary equation, which just describes mu n hat. So this is very similar to what we have in the scalar case. And the solutions to these equations then are shown here. So we have mu sub n is equal to sigma sub zero, which is our prior covariance matrix, times the quantity sigma sub zero plus 1 over n times sigma, that quantity inverse, times mu n hat, plus 1 over n times sigma, times this quantity sigma sub zero plus 1 over n times sigma, quantity inverse, times mu zero. So you'll notice, first of all, that these terms are the same, and we essentially have here, again, awaiting the mean is proportional to our estimate of the mean weighted by this term plus our knowledge about the mean from the prior weighted by this term. So it's a mixing of our prior information and our actual measured information. And the weight, you can sort of see the weights are slightly, you know, the weights are for these two terms a little bit different, but they have the same basic behavior as n increases. As n increases, these terms become zero, and then we essentially have mu n hat here because those two cancel, and here we have another 1 over n, so this whole term goes to zero. So as n becomes large, we give increasing emphasis to our measured mean and less emphasis to our prior mean. But when n is small, we rely more on the prior and less on the estimated mean. And then we have a similar equation for sigma sub n, which is a mixing of the prior covariance matrix and sigma. So again, we see that the probability of x given d then is proportional to a distribution whose mean is mu sub n and whose covariance is sigma plus sigma sub n, where sigma sub n is estimated here. So completely analogous to the scalar case. Just now we're dealing with mean vectors and covariance matrices. So this probability of x given d, this computation can be applied to any situation in which the unknown density can be parameterized. That's essentially another characteristic of the Bayesian approach, is we are adding an additional model to the system, which is a parameterization of the prior probabilities. And we try then to find the parameters of that model, the model for the priors, in addition to the parameters for the likelihood function. So the Bayesian approach can be applied when we parameterize our model for the priors. As we've seen, one of the common ways to do that is to use Gaussians, because when you have the product of a Gaussian for likelihood and a Gaussian for prior, you get somewhat tractable mathematics. From a statistical point of view, the basic assumptions are that the form of the probability of x given theta, where theta are the parameters associated with the model, is assumed to be known, but the value of theta is not known exactly. So this is writing our model for the likelihood computation, p of x, as a function of the parameters of that model. Now, that could be a Gaussian where the parameters are mean and covariance, or that could be some kind of other type of distribution. Our knowledge about theta is assumed to be contained in a known prior. So we have a p of theta, so that the overall probability is going to be p of x given theta times p of theta. And we have knowledge about theta from the prior density. We may, for example, as we'll see later, assume that all values of theta are equally probable. That's what's called an uninformed prior. Or we may have knowledge that other knowledge that tells us one that some values are more probable than others. In addition to this knowledge, the rest of our knowledge about theta is contained in a set of d random variables, x, 1 through n, a set d of n random variables, x, 1 through n, drawn independently according to the unknown probability density function, p of x. So what Bayesian techniques allow us to do is to essentially mix knowledge about the priors with knowledge about the data, with knowledge about the likelihood function, and to essentially do a joint optimization to give us the overall best classification performance. So the posterior for x is p of x given d is equal to the integral of p of x given theta times p of theta given d theta. This is sort of a formal statement of what we just described on the previous slide. Using Bayes' formula, we can write p of d given theta as p of theta given d times is equal to p of d given theta, p of theta over the evidence, the integral of d given theta, p theta, d theta. So this term, this is the probability of the parameters of the model given the data. This is asking, for example, if you had reason to believe that if you're working a problem like the number of people. Let's say if you're working a problem to try to estimate the age of a person, and you had a particular model for the general distribution of the population as a function of age. Generally, when you look at populations, the number of people at a given age is not a Gaussian distribution. It's not a uniform distribution. It's sort of exponentially decaying kind of distribution. You have more young people than older people, kind of thing. Though with some populations, that's actually the slope of that is much different. Some populations age quickly, and they have more. In fact, today the world in general is aging quickly, and we're seeing more older people than we've ever seen before as a percentage of the total population. So that would be you might have that kind of a model as a parameter. I mean, you might have that kind of a model as a prior. You know that the most likely values for age are not uniformly distributed, but they're sort of distributed exponentially. And that's what this is trying to express. And we can then convert this computation, p of theta given d, into p of d given theta, p theta d theta. And by the independence assumption, this p of d given theta can be written as the product of the individual measurements, p of x sub k given theta. So this constitutes, this is sort of a general view, a formal solution to the problem, because we have an expression for the probability of the data given the parameters of the model in terms of the data themselves. This also illuminates the relation of this approach to the maximum likelihood estimate. And we'll explore that a little bit. So suppose that P of D given theta peaks sharply when your estimate of theta is equal to the true estimate. So if so this is another sort of assumption or belief about Bayesian approaches. You have many possible values of theta, right? And you have many possible data sets that you could draw. Now, you know, the thing that, again, I want to keep impressing this semester on you, particularly as graduate students, is that any one data set and any one experimental result drawn from one data set really doesn't have a whole bunch of meaning, because you could have just gotten lucky. You could have got the right data set. You could have somehow got the right choice of the parameters for your model, and you get really good recognition performance or classification performance on your particular test set. But that doesn't mean you're going to get that good performance across all possible test sets, all possible training sets, etc. And in many cases, you'll never know that, because the cost of collecting or generating an evaluation data set and training data is so expensive, you will typically only see one data set in your problem space. Right? I'm hoping many of you can relate to that. I know some of you are working with hypospectral data and things like that. So if you simply optimize your model based on that particular data set, you run a big risk of overgeneralization. And there's no guarantee that when you put that system into service in an actual application that it's going to do well. And Bayesian approaches try to give you that extra bit of insurance that when you field your system on new data, it will do as well as, it'll do reasonably well. Because it's trying to temper the choice of the parameter by all sorts of prior information about the parameter. Now, so that's the good news. Now, the bad news is you have to actually find these Bayesian parameters, or find these parameters according to the Bayesian model, and that's computationally very difficult because of you have to solve these very complicated equations, and we often have to do that iteratively. We have to do a search process for the parameter. And if that space, if all values of that parameter were about the same, if the probability, if you will, was very broad, you could spend forever iterating with some kind of numerical integration algorithm to find the right solution. If that space had lots of local minima, you could easily never find the right answer because your iteration algorithm will get stuck in those local minima. So one of the sort of implicit assumptions about the Bayesian approach is that this distribution of values for the parameters actually very sharply peaked around the true value. So if you do some kind of iterative solution, you will approach the true value very quickly. That's why Bayesian techniques tend to be very aggressive in the way they approach that value. So if P of theta is well behaved, if P of D given theta is sharply peaked at the true value, then P of theta given D will also peak in the same place if P of theta is well behaved. And by well behaved, we mean, for example, that it's sort of like Gaussian, smooth, has a single peak, that kind of thing. Similarly, P of X given D will be approximately P of X given theta hat, which is the ML result. If the peak of P of D given theta is very sharp, then the influence of prior information on the uncertainty of the true value of theta can be ignored. So this is another way of saying that if there's sort of one very clear solution to your model, the influence of prior information is going to be very small on your overall result, and the Bayesian approach will produce a result which is very similar to a maximum likelihood result. And that's not really where Bayesian techniques shine. Where Bayesian techniques shine is the case where there's a lot of uncertainty about the correct value of the parameter, and you want to somehow use all available information to compute P of X given D. You want to use information you might have about the prior, information you have from the measurements X, and information about the forms of the distributions for these things. So people often are disappointed when they go into a problem space and they do a lot of additional computation to find a Bayesian solution, and then they find out that the overall performance of that solution is not significantly better than what they would have gotten with maximum likelihood. That doesn't mean Bayesian techniques failed necessarily. That just might mean that the solution to that problem is not so much dependent on priors. There's no guarantee that priors play a strong role in the solution, but more often than not, it seems reasonable to take into account that information. That also might mean that your model for the prior information is not quite accurate. That's another problem you frequently encounter with Bayesian approaches. In some problem spaces, such as speech recognition, for example, we've gotten a lot of good mileage out of the Bayesian approach. And I think in general, you see across the literature, most state-of-the-art algorithms today in pattern recognition applications seem to be using some type of Bayesian analysis. Now, let's try to reinforce or emphasize this incremental learning process in the Bayesian approach. So let's now look at our data set D explicitly as a, we're going to use this D superscript N as a function of the number of data points in the set. And the question we want to ask is, what happens as we increase the number of samples? So we can write our expression for P of D given theta as P of D superscript N given theta. And that's now going to be the probability of, well, if you remember this, let me go back to, if you remember this equation, P of D given theta is a product of these individual densities. I'm sensing people might not completely appreciate this. When you have an experiment where you draw n events, like you flip a coin n times, you can view the you can ask what was the probability of that particular set of observations that I got. That's the D. And you compute that probability if the events are statistically independent just by taking a product of the probabilities of the individual events. Each one of those events has an underlying probability distribution. They're all the same typically, but it does. So that's what this is essentially expressing, is a product of the underlying distributions. Now the neat thing about this is, if you add an additional event, if you flip the coin once more, because we're using statistical independence and because we're using this product of probabilities, the additional observation is just multiplying one more element on this set. So we can actually write this in a recursive manner. And that's essentially what this recursive Bayes is all about. We can write this as the probability of the previous set times the probability of one more event. So this allows us to write the posterior density P of theta given D sub n as P of D sub n given theta P theta over the integral of P of D sub n given theta P theta D theta. The same thing we wrote before, just now we're using this D sub n. But now that we have this recursive equation, we can write this as P of X sub n given theta times P of D to the n minus 1 given theta divided by the integral of this. This is the bottom is just the evidence. This is called the recursive Bayesian incremental learning, recursive Bayes incremental learning, because we have a method for incrementally updating our estimates. This tells us how we can start with the prior, and we can build with each sample, we can build up to the overall probability distribution using each one of the new data points. And that's another aspect of the Bayesian computations that we will make use of later, and it's sort of integral to the Bayesian approach, is not only are we going to use some kind of gradient descent algorithm for a set of data, for n elements, not only we're going to iterate over those n elements, we're also going to iterate over time. As you add more data, you want to continue iterating on that data. So typically what will happen is you'll do a double iteration. You'll iterate for n data points, you'll add another data point, and then you'll continue iterating. And that's what this is dealing with, what happens when you add that next data point. So it's iteration. You can think of this iteration as a function of time or as a function of the number of data points. So finally today, what I want to talk about is, when do ML and Bayesian estimation differ? Well, for infinite amounts of data, solutions converge. Because when you have infinite amounts of data, you can estimate the priors accurately. And once you have the priors, or the priors are really built in, the priors are really lumped into the likelihood function, everything's fine. But of course, for real problems, you always have limited data. If prior information is reliable, a Bayesian estimate can be superior. And that's a loaded statement, because where does this prior information come from? Well, that comes from knowledge about the application. And typically, I would say that's what separates the statistician from the engineer. Engineers know enough about the application that we can create realistic models for things like prior information. Bayesian estimates for uniform priors are similar to an ML solution. We'll see that repeatedly. So again, there's no difference between the two if you assume uniform priors. If P of theta given D is broad or asymmetric around the true value, the approaches are likely to produce different solutions. And that's just a way of stating that as the priors become less uniform, and as your model for the parameters given the data becomes less Gaussian or less symmetric, then the approaches are likely to produce different solutions. When designing a classifier using these techniques, there's three sources of error. And this important final point today, Bayes error, that's sort of the fundamental error due to overlapping of your data. If your features don't allow you to completely classify, get 0% error, some error is always going to be introduced by the features. It turns out in problems like speech recognition, the Bayes error is actually very high, because the features themselves do not give you high performance recognition. We have to do a lot of other stuff to make those features give you high performance recognition. Then there's the model error. This is the error due to an incorrect model or incorrect assumption about the parametric form. In a lot of problem spaces that you work, people will say, oh, let's assume Gaussian, when you know, in fact, the data is not Gaussian. that's model error. And we do this all the time in speech recognition. For example, we often assume that the features are not only Gaussian, but that they're uncorrelated, that the covariance matrix is a diagonal matrix. Are they in fact correlated? Yes. Are they in fact non-Gaussian? Yes. But we get a lot of mileage out of making a Gaussian assumption. And then there's the estimation error, which is your ability to estimate the parameters of this model are a function of your finite amount of data, and that introduces error in itself. So these are, in general, the three types of errors that you will encounter in applying a Bayesian technique to a problem. Okay, so we'll stop there and we'll pick this up on Monday.